Hello, and welcome back to DS&I Deconstructs. I can't believe it. John, can you believe it? This is our 9th episode.
I also can't believe it's spring.
Right. Well, we do want to shout out to those of us who are doing ritual for the spring equinox, doing ritual for new moon, for Ramadan. We want to hold all of that and say that we are also with you. Thank you for joining us for a rich conversation. We're going to be talking with Lamerche Frazier, beloved artist and activist in this city.
Our guest today is Lamerche Frazier. She has many hats. Visual artist and public historian, for the sake of this conversation and our and just framing of what we want to talk about with her. She is presently the executive director for Spoke Arts and formerly director of education and interpretation for the Museum of African American History in Boston and Nantucket. Her innovative focus supports social and reparative justice and the quest for civil and human rights through the lens of 500 years of Black and Indigenous history. She was awarded the Boston Foundation Brother Thomas Fellowship. She's also served as the artistic community as an award-winning national, international visual and performance artist. In one of her works, Save Me From My Amnesia, with residencies in Brazil, Taiwan, Costa Rica, Africa, the whole country, France, and Cuba. She is a lifetime member of Women of Color Network Quilters, and her collected works are in the Smithsonian, the Winehouse, Minneapolis Institute of Art, and the Dallas Museum of Art. Presently, she serves as a State of Massachusetts Arts Commissioner and was also recently appointed to Mayor Wu's Task Force on Reparations. So we want to start there talking about reparations. So the city of Boston, in terms of when they put out this announcement about the Task Force on Reparations, they talked that it will help the mayor and the city of Boston heal the racial inequities from descendants of slavery. The group is tasked with providing recommendations to the mayor for reparative justice solutions for Black residents. So I guess the first question is, as a member sitting on that board, what does that essentially look like?
That's a good question, and I would like to thank you for inviting me to speak about some of what is currently happening in Boston as a revolutionary city, as a founding city in America, and the arrival of the first documented Africans in 1638 begins this conversation. And I think that the fact that nationally, the questions about reparations have been fostered over many years, at least 25 to my recognition and acknowledgement, but that Boston is now forming a committee of people who are a composite of populations that would be represented across the board, but also engenders the question of, are there enough of us on that particular task force to render the correct recommendations or the best recommendations? There have been academicians, I can name a few of them at UMass, who have been considering this question for over 20 years, and others who may not be named on the committee, but we hope to be able to incorporate their questions, incorporate their comments and responses to what reparations would look like. So at this point, we are headed by the chairman, Joe Feaster, and we will be having our second meeting coming up soon in the month of April. So as a committee, we've not really gelled our consensus and our direction yet, but that will be happening. We are beginning with a research committee and an RFP from the city to comprise people that will be comprised of people who are scholars and academicians who are apt at looking at the archives that are present, that will trace the history of slavery and its impact, that will arc centuries to the 21st century, looking at civil rights and the continuum of what has been discriminatory practices, what has been a result of the impact of slavery on populations of Black and brown people and Indigenous people alike. So it is a big question, and it's a big consideration for any task force to undertake. As we know that this committee is organized to produce a report, we're looking at 2024, we're looking at 2026 and 2030 as benchmarks. Mm-hmm. So based on information that this research committee will help us to produce, we will be able to have some informed and intelligent ways of moving together. And this is our process that we working in.
So you're giving that timeline in terms of the research,
yes.
2024, 2026, 2030, you know, but there's no implementation timeline of when anything is going to be done. Because I'm thinking about, you know, models, and are there any, has there ever been any sort of program or model of reparations that you guys are looking at that's actually worked? I know San Francisco is now looking at some things, but is there something there?
Before I commit us to any model, I'd like to say that we have, as I was saying, we are just newly formed. So that is another part of the process to make decisions on how that format will be developed. And in so doing, taking into consideration the cities of Evanston, mm-hmm. Illinois, mm-hmm. San Francisco, mm-hmm. Los Angeles, and the kind of recent application of policy and its development and recommendations to address reparations, and that we will look at what they have accomplished, what were the strengths and the weaknesses, what are some of the pros, what are the cons, because it's such a huge territory to traverse. Mm-hmm. When you're negotiating 500 years of Black and Indigenous treatment of people across centuries that is framed by slavery, colonialism, imperialism, mm-hmm. you have a lot of territory to look at. There are ways to incorporate policy on housing. There are inequities in, if you're addressing this financially, do you levy money mm-hmm. to redress this? Mm-hmm. When you talk about art and culture, what's there? If we want to even look at time loss, not just land loss, mm-hmm. but time loss, if we had a dollar for every hour mm-hmm. of every day of 400 years of slavery for 12 million people, mm-hmm. what would that look like? Mm-hmm. That's a conservative estimate. So in considering this, there are tentacles that can be, that lead us to a core mm-hmm. of what would feel like relief, repair. And everyone has their own different idea of that mm-hmm. as they bring it to the table.
Really appreciate all of that framing and thinking and intentionality around how this process happens. So I want to focus a little bit on the who, right? Because when you talk about policy, you talk about practice, what is it going to be? You're talking about Black and Indigenous people over a period of time. I want to ask a little bit, what's the case for those who were enslaved, right, in terms of slavery reparations? You know, there are different arguments, if you will, about who should be getting these reparations. So what's your process, or is there one that you all are starting to, like, you can feel germinating around the who? Because a lot of people are asking that question.
I think that's a very complex issue in that, how do you determine the genealogy? How do you determine, there are even laws on the books that talk about one drop of blood identifies you as Black, or the visual apparatus for determining whether you're racially have any African blood. Mm-hmm. And so in determining that is a larger issue of who can actually represent even families of African descended people. When we look at the mark, as I have said before, 1638, who were those Africans that arrived here that came in Boston's Harbor? Mm-hmm. What was their descendancy as they moved on through the years? And we can look at recently having uncovered people whose lives we knew something about, were fleshing the bones of a person like a Phyllis Wheatley, mm-hmm. and her cohort that are arriving directly as young people, mm-hmm. from the West Coast of Africa into Boston. Mm-hmm. And I'm staying particularly close to Boston because of its revolutionary history. But as we think about the different configurations of how families developed from people who are descendants of Africans up and through the Civil War, how they, after that war, look at gaining property rights, mm-hmm. going through the ropes to skip and jump and know how to legislate during Reconstruction. Mm-hmm. And then that being a part of how we advance through to the Great Migration and the change of property and rights and what is happening there. It is a difficult moment for us to see those who were passing for white, even, do they want to be identified that way? What does that do to their descendants? How does that affect them? Mm-hmm. And I think it was Evanston, Illinois, that looked at a period of 1910 through 1969 to say that the residents who got those reparations had to be within that period, mm-hmm. living there, mm-hmm. having some discriminatory practice against them, mm-hmm. that has already at least 10 levels to it, mm-hmm. that we consider. So I think the task force will have a great deal of consideration for coming to agreements, mm-hmm. with how we define reparations. How are we going to wrap it into something that is reasonable in our own minds? Mm-hmm. And that idea of agreement is going to be broad also, because satisfying what is a question is not necessarily homogeneous activity. There's going to be a variety of people who come with different information to a question. Mm-hmm. So there will be some variety in results that are the answer. Mm-hmm. If we get to that. Mm-hmm. So I think importantly, we're going to have to ask some questions that get to the meat or the core. And developing the questions might be more important than getting to the answers, mm-hmm. To provide that pathway for us to get there. And how much consideration? We have people like David Hall, who is on the Reparations Task Force, mm-hmm. who has been in charge of the Charles Houston Law Institute, mm-hmm. at Harvard, who has this background in policy development and legislation and legal application through the courts as a repository of his knowledge. Mm-hmm. And so he can ask contemporary issues that have to do with this continuum of civil rights, mm-hmm. and human rights. Mm-hmm. And then you have people who are who are positioned to ask moral questions. Mm-hmm. You have historians and scholars who can fill. So as we look at this, it is, for me, it is not very simple. Mm-hmm. It is one that we hope to have our best effort in to bring forward some solutions, but certainly nothing is going to be perfect.
Thank you. Thank you for that answer. I'm fascinated by your framing around a question, mm-hmm. and thinking about, There are moral questions. There are justice questions. There's housing questions. There's all that framing. There's also emotional questions, right? So as I think about, you know, in terms of the literature and in terms of the discussion that has happened over many years, you know, there's the emotional question about, well, I didn't own any slave from a certain sector of the population. And then there are questions even within the diaspora of, you know, what does that have to do with me? Or, you know, within this context, especially, you know, from a North American context, right? Mm-hmm. You know, if you're from the Caribbean or if you're from Africa or if you're from somewhere else. So I'm thinking about what the experience of the opponents of slavery representations and their questions and how we're approaching that, you know?
Well, I think also even in, and I keep referring to this 2019 evidence of some reparative justice applied in Evanston, Illinois. There was a proposal for a 3% tax from the sale of cannabis to be applied to have this reservoir of $10 million over 10 years to distribute to the citizens of Evanston. And you ask yourself, if cannabis was suddenly then legalized, and reparations monies are coming from the legal sale, I have to ask, what about those who were jailed for the sale of cannabis and what has happened to their lives since then? And was that justice as we look at how this money is being collected? But the fact that they are taxpayers who are positioned in ways that are diverse ethnically, diverse culturally, and may take offense to this levy on their taxes to pay for what they think they have not participated in.
Or benefited from.
We have to really think about what that is. And there is a an oppositional force that has organized itself in Illinois to have some redress on that question and to see if this is anywhere near fair or equitable. Mm-hmm. Does it also incur harm happening again? So the question from one of the organized committees has been, if we repair this harm, can we guarantee that there is legislation that will help this not happen again? And this is only with regard to the issue of housing as an inequity. And we think about the health and wealth gap. We think about mental health. What has that been as an impact of slavery being a part of the fabric of American society? What does that bring us to in terms of how we look at addressing health issues? So it still is a big arena, at any rate, and the opposition to how this will be levied and how this will be collected and then how it will be dispersed are the things that we will have to grapple with as we try to seek some remedy and seek some repair.
Thank you for that clarification. I want to see if we can shift a little bit because I know, you know, H.R. 40, which I'm sure that you're familiar with, and the bill that is there to support that Representative Sheila Jackson, I believe it is, worked really deeply and arduously at this for many years to just get it there. Do you see things like that or this type of bill, other legislation? Is there space for more legislative energy behind looking at these things?
Absolutely. I think I'd like to applaud those who have made an attempt at such a task and at what gives us some modeling to either emulate or cast off. Mm-hmm. As pioneers and legislators who have taken this under their belt, it's a courageous step for them to even approach this. But it does give us either a mirror or a looking glass or a lens mm-hmm. to think about as we make recommendations from this task force. It gives us a microscope to analyze, to see if this can be successful, what we can try in Boston. There is a mandate for us to look at the demographics in this city mm-hmm. and apply it with respect to who was here from the beginning. Mm-hmm. And then who is here, who has entered as immigrants? Boston has been declared a sanctuary city. Mm-hmm. So we have descendants of African people globally represented in Boston. Mm-hmm. We have other ethnic ties to the world that have to be considered in this, who are paying taxes, who are working in Boston, who make Boston what it is mm-hmm. For many classes. So, that being the case, legislation that has already been done across the country will help us to examine where we can be and what it will look like here.
Yeah, that makes sense. I know that there are certainly some sentiments, I'm sure, here in Boston, as many other cities, that are those who are, you know, hearkening a little bit back to the previous question that I asked around the who, you know, you make a compelling, and I'm sure that there is the compelling argument about anyone from the African diaspora, anyone who is considered Black, anyone, whether they've immigrated to Boston or they were born, raised, bred in Boston, because they are of the African diaspora, we want to see how we can, you know, add some remedy, some thinking, some collective holding of the entire body. But for those who are like, listen, we are Boston strong. We are Black Boston. We've been here. I don't know about those folks coming in. Yep, they had their own thing, but we've been here and we've been impacted by the systemic issues that are particular to Boston in a way that those who immigrated later did not. So can you talk about, you know, I'm bringing up a little bit of the nuance of, again, what people are raising. How might the commission even hold something like that? I mean, that seems pretty intense and great.
Well, I don't profess to have that answer, but I think that the committee will have to hold that, consider it, and come up with some remarks about it or some recommendations that may not satisfy everyone, but at least approach some of that issue. The body of that task force will determine what those questions and that content will really be. Mm-hmm. But for instance, I went to a recent symposium at Boston College on land loss, reparations, and housing policy. Mm-hmm. And one of the first panels that was presented in the conference presented on agricultural property and farmland mm-hmm. and its loss. Mm-hmm. So that became a regional consideration. A question was raised from the audience. Well, we're in New England, mm-hmm. and we want to know how you plan to address loss here. Mm-hmm. Property loss. At another portion in the conference, there was a focus on a lawyer mm-hmm. who had actually advocated for the return of beach property in LA to a family called Bruce, mm-hmm. mm-hmm. Who received this property, who actually bought this property right after Reconstruction mm-hmm. in the 1800s, and they lost the property. And then there were legislative and other kind of policy issues that this white community, who did not want this family to ever be resourceful and have a resort in that area, had applied, and he took it upon himself mm-hmm. to actually represent this family and the descendants of those who had lost the property mm-hmm. and was successful in gaining it. Mm-hmm. So as a reparative practice, mm-hmm. he was able to be successful. Who knows how many cases could be opened with respect to that? Mm-hmm. That's a different region, but I'm sure that could apply to families in Boston, absolutely. In fact, the first woman, Black woman to own yes. property.
Mm-hmm. Yes, come on.
Is Zipporah Potter.
Yes.
Zipporah Potter Atkins, yes. who was uncovered by Vivian Johnson, Dr. Vivian Johnson. And there's a marker for her on the Rose Kennedy Greenway. And remarkably, she acquired property in 1670, that mm-hmm. early. Mm-hmm. So, you know, where does that take us? How much consideration do we have to give to those who were here in Boston mm-hmm. and were and have survived as families and generationally would have been affected by all of the redlining and the lack of loans that happened and the application of discriminatory practices with respect to land and property and real estate. Mm-hmm. So that's a very big question. Mm-hmm. How do we do that? And those who acquired land and property who came from without and invested their generations in America who were from other places, what happens with their acquisition of land and property? And does it continue to build wealth for those families? Even looking at the aspect of what has become land trust, and I know I'm with DS&I right here in the room, and we look at, are we going to be satisfied with communities owning land mm-hmm. to address loss?
Right.
Or are we still going to be looking at how that does not necessarily address generational wealth okay. and property ownership? So perfect solutions are, wow, far eons away. Mm-hmm. And I just think that it is an opportunity, though, for us to really focus on what's happening in this Boston, greater Boston area to bring some remedy. So while we know that the process is going to be long and arduous, mm-hmm. It took 500 years to get here. Are we going to be able to do it in a minute, in 2 weeks? I don't think so. Mm-hmm. But and we have an opportunity to at least look at what we can do, mm-hmm. what is within our resource base to address this. And I think Mayor Wu has called it a renaissance in art and culture and a renaissance in the decision to address property. Is it a rebirth? Is my question, as we think about the word renaissance, mm-hmm. or has it been with us all the time? And it being a human issue of the right to exist, as we think about the Declaration of Human Rights from the United Nations, as number 6 says, as an article, every person has the right to exist. Mm-hmm. They have the right to be housed mm-hmm. in the earth. How important is that general rule applied as a pinpoint in Boston on the map and geographically addressed by the visitation of all these people who are from around the world who've decided to make this their home?
Oh, that's a lot, and it's dense, and it's going to be a lot to tease apart. Questions that are coming to my mind is, you know, the one thing that you just said was really talking about land, right? Land as the either acquisition of land or the return of land, as a reparative kind of move. That's finite and concrete. Can you talk a little bit about some of the other areas? When you talk about reparative, you spoke earlier about, you know, the sense of one's own humanity, right? What was lost in that, in being enslaved. Is there a way to repair for that? Like, I see that people are talking about reparative in economics, reparative in land, and all those things are vitally important. Can you talk a little bit about the actual soul repair, right? The somatic repair, the psychobiology repair. Is this going to be something that the commission is also looking at in terms of reparations, or are they looking towards, again, more material things, which of course we need? Ain't nobody giving that back. You're going to leave all, I got sticky hands. I always say, I got sticky hands. You put some money on the table, I'm coming again. No. But what do you have, what can you share with us about that? Or what's your sense and feeling?
Well, I think the measure of value of wealth has been based in land and property. If we look at the equation of those who were able to gain property by kidnapping and theft, then those who were displaced of their property and loss, who were indigenous, and those who were deemed property. Mm-hmm. As Africans,
come on.
Then we can describe in some measure of accuracy what determines wealth in America. Mm-hmm. It's about those property relations. So it's very difficult to move away from that as a space of occupation. Mm-hmm. But when we think about intellectual property, mm-hmm. and what that means, enslaved people were announcing in their biography, in their autobiographies, in their narratives, in their poems, in the way that they wrote, mm-hmm. their status. Mm-hmm. Servant of, Phyllis Wheatley writes, Negro servant of John Wheatley. Mm-hmm. Frederick Douglass writes that he's enslaved, as he writes his narrative in 1845. So when we talk about this intellectual property, how do we pay for that? Mm-hmm. It is Notes on States of Virginia that Thomas Jefferson talks about the wealth of land and property and intellectual property and who has the rights to it. And with those inventions that come along and laws on patents, mm-hmm. who is claiming the right of that? When we look at even an Onesimus Mather, who is purported to be the person who brings from Ghana, mm-hmm. inoculation, mm-hmm. as a process in 1721, mm-hmm. the doctors who take onus of it, Cotton Mather, mm-hmm. Being a reverend, is confiding in doctors in London, and in the academy in London is where this is hailed as the way to prevent smallpox from killing everyone. Mm-hmm. And yet Onesimus was a gift from his congregation, from the congregation of Cotton Mather, as a gift to the reverend. Mm-hmm. How do we repair that? Mm-hmm. This man with an ingenious practice that he's bringing to save 14% of the population in Boston at that time, mm-hmm. from smallpox, yet he's relegated to the recesses, mm-hmm. of history, mm-hmm. the narrative that needs to be repaired. Mm-hmm. So how do we assess a value, mm-hmm. on that is my question. As we move forward and we look at education, mm-hmm. and the resources to education, who gets to go to the best schools? What are the laws that keep families that are communities that are less than 50 in like 1796, mm-hmm. from being able to teach English grammar, mm-hmm. in their schools? Mm-hmm. And then you have the formation of schools like Boston Latin that become this public school where the elite are going to attend. Mm-hmm. Those that are privy to the best of what becomes resources for financial and economic accumulation. Mm-hmm. How do we repair that? Mm-hmm. So is education and a free education a part of the repair that we get to give to the descendants of African and indigenous people? Mm-hmm. Is that a concern? Mm-hmm. So when we move from, and that becomes material mm-hmm. as its result, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. The idea that there are many obstacles to even understanding the language of particular professions mm-hmm. that have been a course of climbing that mountain that Black and Indigenous people have had to do because of the impacts of slavery. When you think of the biotech industry, mm-hmm. what are the codes there? Do even our students get exposed to that is an area that you can go into with biochemistry and innovation mm-hmm. in this day? How many of them know about the careers there? Mm-hmm. That information network and highway and that of creating a space of advancement mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. that is on par. Mm-hmm. There have been even conferences around the binary language that computers, computer science is based around. Mm-hmm. And there is a woman, a sister, who created an organization around girls being able to code. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Why is that necessary? It's necessary because we've been kept out mm-hmm. of even communication in the languages of industries that are advancing and going on from the 21st century into the future. Mm-hmm. So is that a consideration of our reparatory apparatus?
Yes. Yes,
so I would say yes. Philosophically, there's, in a sense, many questions we'll never be able to answer or may not be able to. Like, we can frame all the questions and we may never actually come to sort of a holistic answer of how we do it. And I do, however, think that, and I appreciate all the things you shared, and so much of it, I think, in this conversation has been about, to Farai's, one of Farai's point earlier about land and housing and, you know, sort of an economic framing, which I think is really important as we're in this time of thinking about wealth building, especially for, you know, people of color and indigenous folks. But I also think that arts and culture have a place to play in this. So you know, sort of, because so much of arts and culture, especially from people of color, has been cannibalized. Mm-hmm. And so where's that on the spectrum and how do we deal with that? And, you know, as we think about, you know, money changing hands and, you know, I just think about like Boston, so many great arts organizations, so many great people who are, you know, doing cultural presentations and all that. What makes the economic impact of arts and cultural organizations unique? What do you think here?
Yeah. And can I just also add to that, this idea of intellectual property from artists and creatives and Black entrepreneurs is also wrapped up in that. So, yeah, if you can touch on that.
Well, I do think that if we stay in the arena of art being a document of time, its creativity in being able to express ideas that might not as readily be seen mm-hmm. on the written page, but then there's literary art also.
Mm-hmm. Phyllis Wheatley,
Zora Neale Hurston. Mm-hmm. We can go on forever,
right?
James Baldwin, you know, forever. But that this well of creativity has been levied against documents like Notes on the State of Virginia mm-hmm. that give a very dim view of our intellectual capacity to be creative, relegated to the space of the beasts by doctrines that then became law. So against that backdrop, art and culture of Black and Indigenous people, BIPOC people, period, has been a claim of space that is vulnerable. It has had its vulnerabilities in being exploited. Songs not being purchased that are put into mainstream culture or what has been called the dominant culture that have really originated with people who did not have the same kind of access. So when we think about the opportunity for Boston to live up to its name as a creative city, then funds have to be levied to allow the creatives who are identified as Black and brown people in this city to have the resource to continue their creativity, to continue to push out the excellent genius production that they're capable of doing, but need the support to showcase Boston as this place that's going to talk about being equitable in the arts and honoring culture and celebrating culture. When I think about the organization that I'm with, Spoke Art, we have a cadre of young people that have come from Boston Housing Authority that are concerned about how they live across 26 neighborhoods under the laws of Boston Housing Authority and are not able to necessarily voice their opinions except through a grant that we've received from the Boston Housing Authority to create a leadership council of these youth who, through the cultural arts, will be able to create a lens that helps them to lead the voice of the future in those neighborhoods. What they want to see in a public art expo, what they want to reimagine in a space of public art in their neighborhoods that is relevant to them and their ideas and the advance of the American landscape, holding equity, holding fairness, holding justice. So having the opportunity to showcase that kind of resource with these youth has been important as a lens. But when we think about how now the city is restructuring for those same youth who would be under a program that has been normally administered through the city with funds going to 47 nonprofit art organizations. The redefining of that has now resulted in this summer that those organizations will receive funds from the city, but not directly. They will be funneled through four lead organizations that are
mainly. Are they then going to funnel them?
There's BCYF, there is Artists for Humanities as a lead organization, and two others. And so what that does for those 47 organizations, smaller organizations, is that the work of distributing, paying payroll for the youngsters who would come through those programs, that 11.5% of operational cost doesn't go to those 47. It goes to the lead organizations for handling this. So just that subtle shift in how a program under the city has been managed changes the distribution of the funds to operate. So what do those 47 organizations then do? They are not as competitively in a place already that gives them the space that the four lead organizations have. So I think we have to look at asking our policymakers and legislators and people in these departments in the city to reconsider that it may seem like a great idea, mm-hmm. but did you ask us?
Right.
Did you ask? And did you consider what that might do to keep the level of status quo of organizations that are already the largest organizations there mm-hmm. and not engender the fueling mm-hmm. of the smaller organizations? And so when we get to Black and Brown creative organizations that have been upstarts from COVID and during that period and are now really activist mm-hmm. organizations for art and culture to survive, mm-hmm. we have to think about what is going to be this distribution of funds for them to do this.
Yeah, it's interesting. What you're raising was identified in the Boston Creates Report in terms of their community engagement process, where they talked about there is not enough space, there is not enough funding, there's not enough just foundational support for artists, and especially artists of color, BIPOC artists. So as we think about that, I think there's also, you know, on the other hand, that as we think about the diaspora as exists in Boston, you know, one of the things that comes up sometimes is that the arts and culture focus is mainly African-American and does not incorporate or somehow engender artists who come from the larger diaspora. And then because so much of it may not happen in our communities, right? It may come from there, but you know, I was in a discussion recently where people were saying, you know, but who will participate in artistic endeavors that happen in Mattapan and Roxbury and Dorchester, and you know what I mean? As we think about the refurbishing of the Strand and some of these other places. And sometimes that's a challenge too, right? So there's space and who will come there and who participate and how will folks benefit. There's just the funding that you're talking about and who will have access to that and how much, and you know, and then who's showcasing, who gets to showcase their art and their talent, and where does it come from? You know, who is it coming from? So can you talk about that? And from your perspective, how have you seen that? How can we, you know, take on some of those challenges?
Well, I think that's a very important question that you're raising, because it may tiptoe on reorganization and collaborative partnerships among the smaller entities being necessary to make some demands, being necessary to say, no, this is not sufficient, mm-hmm. that what good is it if you're giving me crumbs from the table that make me compete with others who are getting crumbs from the table. Mm-hmm. It does not make for a holistic representation, acknowledgement, and respect for art and culture that could be robust in the city, that could be an industry that brings tourism to the city in large numbers and helps to elevate it economically. So when we look at the offices of art and culture in the city of Boston and their resources, who's thinking about who gets what? We look at, there is an organization called Now and There that is planning a triennial, and the administration of that organization, a triennial is what it's called, by 2026, to showcase arts in Boston. They're a large organization. They have raised a large amount of money, but they are, once again, those who have are them that get. Those them that gets are those that get. And, you know, we still remain with the smaller organizations, not necessarily represented, but we hope that they will include smaller organizations in the planning and the process of this. In terms of reorganization in arts and culture, it is going to have to be coming, I think, from a grassroots level. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Those who have the less to lose, the less at, but more at stake, mm-hmm. if you will, by reorganizing, reimagining what can happen and exploring the possibilities of how we can accomplish this together. Mm-hmm. Because what happens as a result of our experience is that the divide and conquer, the keeping divided, not necessarily to conquer with the intention of conquering, but not intentionally that of helping and supporting to survive, is the mark that of most of the funding that has been happening. And individuals in the departments have made some strides in advancing and thinking about this, but we need more attention to it. We need a voice of creatives that is really heard here in the city.
It's interesting. We have universities with huge endowments. We have arts organizations with lots of funding.
Yes.
You know, as we think about repair, as we think reparative, you know, is there not a space for some of those universities and some of those arts organizations, that grassroots organizations can leverage relationships with them, right? I think that can all be part of the discussion in some sense.
Yes. I am a part of a residency under the auspices of Northeastern University, begun by Dana Chandler, who is a visual artist and activist who was a part of the Black arts movement from the 1960s, who started a residency called AMARP, mm-hmm. African American Artists in Residency program.
I'm trying to get to the exhibit at AMARP right now, a few of my artists and colleague friends. So yes, please continue.
It's comprised of 14 artists. Dana actually was offered space on Northeastern's campus mm-hmm. originally just for himself. And it was large space, and he decided to incorporate other artists in Boston. And that was on Leon Street as a manifested space mm-hmm. of community and artist. Mm-hmm. That space moved to 76 Atherton Street in Jamaica Plain, mm-hmm. where we currently reside. Mm-hmm. So it has been a process of over 30 years mm-hmm. in its development and its representation of the African diaspora, if you will. Artists who are professionals, who create excellent work in many different genres, mm-hmm. and has had now the experience of over multiple years of defending that space to keep it as a residency. Mm-hmm. And so we are in negotiations with Northeastern University, and the city of Boston at one time was helping to negotiate the space to keep it to or assign a new space mm-hmm. for us. And our fight for the keys to our studios continues.
Yeah.
Even though there have been some movements, some spaces recommended, there have been some even accusing us of being freeloaders mm-hmm. while we create this cultural niche that is unique in America mm-hmm. for Northeastern University to boast about. And now they want to take that name, and they want to take that space and use it to develop their own programming mm-hmm. rather than honor the ongoing possibilities of what these master artists can help to produce in terms of art production, but also to ignite younger artists and help them as mentors mm-hmm. rather than reinventing the wheel as we usually have to do, mm-hmm. but taking this space as a positive, institutionalized zone mm-hmm. of art production and honor, even to bring resident artists from other places in the world to expose to this community. But the community presentations and practices have been interrupted by this this fight for not being displaced, not being erased. And so we continue that fight. And we ask community support all the time for making its voice. But we know that larger universities take land. They use it. They and they have the resources, as John was saying, you know, their ability to be able to have funds in escrow and just keep it going and keep it moving, as just opposed to what community has and what, you know, artists would have as their resources. So this is indicative of places in the country also where artists are losing their spaces, where they have created these magnificent zones of activity and heart swell and pride, where now through gentrification and other apparatus, they're being moved out. Developers are taking those spaces to bring in populations that not necessarily will use it the same way.
Yeah, absolutely. And this is an ongoing thing. I mean, historically, you think about the Piano Factory and what happened with that situation. You think about Humphrey Street Studios. There have been several, and we want to applaud and lift up Humphrey Street because they were, I'm just like, yes, we got a little, so we held on to a little something. Yes. But that is the constant, as you say, challenge, because really, you know, capitalism is what seems to be that's what it points to, where they can get the biggest amount of money. And so when you know, we're here having a conversation about reparations, we're here having a conversation about how the arts in this moment in the conversation anyway can support, right, whether it's messaging, whether it's showing up to do, you know, we all know at the table that I've done a lot of cultural organizing in the city and how the arts can be used to activate, signal towards an action that we want to see happening. But if we take the spaces that the creatives and the artists and the entrepreneurs are actually creating that so that we can support it, it's drawing not only from the artists themselves and their capacity to build and mold and do wonderful art, but that cultural arm of the organizing that needs to happen. So it seems to be a both end. It seems to be impacting at every level across. In maybe closing, but I want to check in with John. Can you just talk a little bit about if we had what is the vision? What does it look like? What could it be? We always want to leave, if we can, with the vision. We can talk always about the problem, right, and all the challenges. But how might the arts and culture support the move towards reparations in Boston?
Well, I think that, first of all, the lifting of voice is where we begin. Communicating, bridging these areas where we think we're isolated, but bringing them to a point where the voice can be heard from our different neighborhoods. Boston is quite a complex place in terms of what voices may be represented across class, across gender, across race, across many economic classes. But I think our information systems are more of what we need to demand correct information to erase our economic ignorance, as you raise that systemic element of capitalism as it operates. How do we then interrupt what capitalism does to us, maybe even still using it as the vehicle through which we operate, as we dismantle and deconstruct capitalism as a system that is not fair. How do we create and envision new wealth? mm-hmm. new avenues and apparatus for functioning as humans, mm-hmm. in as a collective repaired. If we can see that vision and then walk backwards mm-hmm. from the vision to enact policies, to enact and develop spaces that will help us mm-hmm. to do this, I think we can constantly ask the question, are we there yet? Mm-hmm. Are we there yet? Are we there yet? And keep that energy going. Concrete answers, I don't know. Mm-hmm. But I think that as we have more sessions like this, mm-hmm. this has been lifting mm-hmm. to me to even participate, that's important. But beyond the participation in talking, mm-hmm. we have to have our calls to action, yes, and our manifestos of what we're going to have the spaces, the places, the resources, the people reflected in and be like. So it's a job.
And every time we posit something like that, we have to think. I think about, you know, in this time where truth is very pliable. It's shifting, right? Mm-hmm. Many different versions of the truth. You know, and how to achieve this level of collective repair. How do we get to an understanding, you know, when we are so fractured, even within sometimes our own communities, you know? So I think as you're saying, like, we have to continue having these conversations, but we have to move to something that will actually do the work of deconstructing it, you know? So it's the conversation, but there has to be a movement towards doing that. Yes. Yeah.
Yeah, that movement is extremely important. I remember when the mural that was on Warren Street, there was mm-hmm. a Mandela mural mm-hmm. done by Demi Five and a group of mural artists. Mm-hmm. And it was to come down.
Yeah,
but shout out to the young people who came out and protested mm-hmm. at least to make a voice to say, this is not what we want. Mm-hmm. And, you know, invited several of us to talk, but that these are the actions. Our protests, our wants, our desires expressed.
Wonderful. That is a nice, a lovely note. We always want to be able to offer some kind of action that we want to be inviting our listeners to do, to engage in. Lamurchie, this has been a rich conversation, as you said, many more to be had. Thank you so much
for joining us.
I always learn when I'm in your presence. You are being held in our hearts here at Dudley Street Neighborhood Initiatives, and we want to just say
thank you.
Thank you.
Well, thank you. We all belong together.